Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Marcy Krivenen. Emergency crews recovered two bodies from a tent in the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness. Lightning may be to blame.
After too many bear-human conflicts, the Forest Service mandates bear-resistant containers for backpackers.
A new bus service from Glenwood to Denver started this week.
So how do we get folks to the doctor? How do we get them to business appointments? How do we get them possibly into Denver so they can have access to DIA.
A quaint theater in downtown Carbondale celebrates 30 years.
And we introduce you to an Aspen Music School student with an unconventional background.
No one in my family is a musician, so the kind of music I was exposed to was, Bruce Springsteen and, Neil Young.
Hospital emergency rooms in our region are seeing more Medicaid patients.
Finally, we profile a Grammy-nominated band from Denver whose name means girl in Russian.
Emergency crews recovered the bodies of a father and son who were camping in the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness Wednesday.
Officials think lightning may have caused the deaths of the two males, an adult and a juvenile, at a campsite south of West Maroon Pass. Hikers initially found the two unresponsive in their tent at 11,000 feet elevation. A Flight for Life helicopter took a Mountain Rescue Aspen crew to the site where officials removed the bodies. The brother and sister of the deceased, who were sleeping in a tent nearby, found them in the tent. They were unharmed and were walking toward the Maroon Bells parking lot when rescue crews met them. The two were taken to Aspen Valley Hospital for an evaluation. While initial indications point to a lightning strike as the cause of the deaths, autopsies still need to be done, and an official cause of death has yet to be released. The names of the deceased are being withheld until family is notified. In light of this event, the Pitkin County Sheriff's Office is putting out a warning. Be weather aware, especially in the backcountry, and take actions to protect yourself if there's a storm.
Too many people are storing food in their tents in the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness, so the Forest Service is mandating bear-proof containers.
Forest Service District Ranger Karen Schroyer says the decision comes after recent human-bear conflicts in the heavily used wilderness area. It stretches over 160,000 acres and includes the Maroon Bells Scenic Area. The emergency order requires backcountry campers to store food, garbage, and other smelly items in a hard-sided bear-resistant container. The canisters weigh between 2 and 4 pounds and cost about $70 at retailers like the Ute Mountaineer. The store also rents them out. Before the mandate, Forest Service staff was just encouraging campers to use the canisters. Now, if you're caught, you could get a misdemeanor charge and possibly a $5,000 fine, a short stint in prison, and an even larger fine is possible for commercial outfitters breaking the rule. Starting this week, it's possible to hop on a CDOT bus to Denver with a few stops in between, but there isn't any weekend service.
On what's being called the Bustang service, riders will pay $28 to ride 3.5 hours from Glenwood to Denver's Union Station. If passengers want to continue to Denver's airport, a connecting bus brings that cost to just under $40 and about 5 hours total travel time. Riders can catch a bus to other cities on the Front Range, too. Since Bustang service only runs weekdays, I called up Mark Imhoff to ask why. He's CDOT's Director of Transit and Rail, and says it's important to look at the big picture.
Our commission, in wanting us to start small and wanting to make sure that we have initial success, they did guide us into only weekday service. We will be doing more outreach, and I have every expectation that we are going to expand the service, assuming we have success with what we begin with.
Imhoff points out that this is CDOT's first time running its own transit service. The idea is to connect the handful or so biggest public transportation systems already in place across Colorado. That includes the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority.
When we look at the purpose and the trips that we're trying to serve, I think it's probably obvious that along the Front Range, we're looking at commuter-type service. And in the mountain corridor, that's a lot more difficult because of the long distances there. So in talking with those transit agencies along the line, the input that we got and the rationale we put forward was not so much a commuter base, but more what we've termed essential services. So how do we get folks to the doctor? How do we get them to business appointments? How do we get them possibly into Denver so they can have access to DIA? And the thought is that those are predominantly weekday trips.
Mark Imhoff oversees transit and rail for CDOT, which is rolling out its Bustang bus service along the I-70 corridor and on the Front Range. The West Line, which connects to Glenwood Springs, has cost about $1.2 million so far.
URSA Resources Group held what it called an education meeting Tuesday. The Battlement Mesa gathering was about a proposal for new natural gas drilling.
URSA wants to drill around 50 wells in the coming year or two. If approved by a long list of agencies, they would be on two pads in Battlement Mesa. Don Simpson is Vice President of Business Development for URSA.
The original plan in the PUD called for 14 pads in 1982. The pads were all designated, locations and everything, along with pipelines.
Ultimately, URSA wants to develop six new pads. Simpson and others answered many critical questions from neighbors concerned about possible impacts on the community.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Marcy Krivenin. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
The Crystal Theater in Carbondale has been a staple of the Roaring Fork Valley for three decades. Bob and Kathy Ezra are the theater's owners since the beginning.
It made it through tough economic times and a changing movie industry by showing the films they like and without previews. Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort spoke with the couple about what they've learned about running a theater.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having us.
Can you just reflect on 30 years for me?
Oh, gosh. In some respects, it seems like it's gone by really fast, but in other respects, it seems like 30 years is a lifetime. You know, I don't think either of us, when we really started out with this, envisioned ourselves doing it 30 years later. I think, you know, you just kind of, it was just something that we do, and we never looked back, and people have been so supportive from the very beginning that we just keep doing it and time just kind of flies. And then you have landmark events like every 10 years and you realize, wow, I'm proud that we've lasted this long. And, you know, it's not an easy business, especially for a small business.
So a few years ago when you made the transition from film to digital, you had a lot of support from the community. Tell me about what it means to have that support and what it feels like to be a part of the Valley community.
It's really humbling. You know, it's not something you can ever take for granted. We've just been so fortunate that people have been interested in coming to the Crystal Theater for 30 years. And the demographics of the Valley have changed somewhat, and the population has increased, and some new people are finding us, and it's just really satisfying that we are able to offer them a product that they enjoy. Without them, we wouldn't be here.
So you mentioned how the community kind of motivates you. Is it ever difficult to keep going? If you didn't have their support, do you think you would have stopped a while ago, maybe?
Well, if we didn't have their support, it would have been difficult to stay in business.
Yeah.
Because we are a small theater, and you know, we try to keep our expenses to a minimum, and you know, we're there all the time, and we try to keep our costs low, but there's still, the studios expect the same from us as they expect from, you know, a multiplex. It's still about the magic of the movies, and that's something that doesn't change. I mean, for me, at least, it's still magical 30 years later. I mean, somebody asked me once how I handle working every night and everything. How do I handle the stress when I go home? And it's like I watch movies. We're big fans of TCM, and you know, we just are really enjoy movies.
So you have 30 more years of industry experience now. You have 30 more years of life experience. Is there anything you would do differently?
I have to think about that.
In terms of film selection and operations, I would say no. For me, I would say no. The only thing I might do differently would
try to have a night off.
Yeah, maybe a regular
night off. You know, we get away to, you know, we can get away for 3 or 4 days. You know, people can run the place, but I don't feel like, you know, I regret or we did anything that we should have done it differently. You know, I think we made, you know, the choices we made were good. And I mean, we're real big believers in timing. For some reason, our timing has been pretty good.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you. Yeah. It was fun.
That's Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort reporting from the Edlis Neeson Foundation Arts and Culture Desk. Patrick spoke with Bob and Kathy Ezra, owners of the Crystal Theater in Carbondale.
Aspen has city rules preventing employees and elected officials from accepting certain kinds of gifts. At the same time, employees accept expensive passes to one of the biggest events of the summer.
The municipal government receives around 24 passes to the Food and Wine Classic held in June, which City Attorney Jim True describes this way.
Food and wine is incredibly important to the city.
Passes are expensive, fetching $1,400. The Chamber of Commerce receives many pairs, which are then passed on to the City of Aspen. Clerk Linda Manning.
We received 11 sets, and so we had a lottery drawing this year for distribution, and so employees could sign up, and they received a pair of passes.
City representatives say the passes have been given to the government for so many years, it's hard to remember when the tradition started. City Attorney Jim True believes that longevity shows the passes are not about influencing officials or city staff to treat food and wine differently than other special events. True is sure the passes meet the city's ethical guidelines, too.
The code says fairly clearly that a member of the city shall not accept a gift of substantial value or substantial economic benefit that would tend to improperly influence a reasonable person to depart from the faithful and impartial discharge of his duties.
Some in other local governments have questioned whether city officials are influenced simply by allowing the event to affect town as much as it does. But the practice does meet the letter of the law regardless.
Code also goes on to say that certain gifts are not deemed to be considered gifts of substantial value, and those include tickets to sporting, recreational, educational, and cultural events in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Those tickets are excluded because they're only good for a weekend, and when it comes to food and wine in particular, it's helpful for city staff and leadership to see how the festival is run. A key part of the festival is on city property, streets are closed off, and other changes are made in town to help the event go smoothly. This summer, the city switched to the lottery method instead of handing passes over to department heads. Some passes are still set aside for certain people, like the city manager's office and city council members. The Colorado Municipal League in Denver agrees that Aspen's acceptance of the passes is in good legal standing. When asked why staff and officials don't just pay for their own passes to Food and Wine, attorney Jim True says that's an option, but the usual 22 passes makes it possible for far more staff and officials to attend.
Aspen Public Radio News is airing a series on weekday mornings this summer where we profile students of the Aspen Music Festival and School. Patrick Fort brings you the second installment of Time Signatures, Measures of Tomorrow's Musicians.
The upright bass is big, heavy, and sometimes inconvenient, but under a tall tree next to a pond, Will Langley Miletich doesn't seem to mind any of that. That's Will playing his double bass. Will comes from what would be an unconventional background in comparison to many of his peers at the school. His parents were fans of Bruce Springsteen, the Boss. He began playing the guitar in the third grade.
You know, no one in my family is a musician, so the kind of music I was exposed to was, you know, Bruce Springsteen and, you know, Neil Young and especially Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. So that was kind of my first musical exposure, was to those kind of, you know, more popular groups.
It's Will's first year in Aspen. He grew up in Seattle, just north of the University of Washington. He says that the mountains in Aspen remind him a bit of home, but now he's in the mountains rather than next to them. In middle school, Will's music teacher suggested that he make the switch to bass while playing classical music with his school band. Not too much later, he would discover jazz.
I remember in sixth grade, one of the first jazz and classical artists I fell in love with was Wes Montgomery, the great jazz guitarist.
Will is an avid Seattle sports fan and lover of New Wave French cinema from the 60s. And as Will's music taste evolved, his playing evolved. Shortly after discovering jazz, he discovered classical music through Tchaikovsky. Early on in high school, he continued to play the guitar in his jazz ensemble and his bass in the classical group. But soon, he would go to the bass full time. Now he plays jazz and classical equally.
And then gradually throughout high school, the guitar just kind of stayed in its case and the bass came out of its case more. So I think around my junior year in high school, I just decided to focus on bass exclusively, you know, not even think about guitar.
The 18-year-old bass man studies at the Curtis School of Music in Philadelphia. Will says that he thinks that being able to play jazz and classical gives him an advantage over some of his peers. The pure creativity and improvisation of jazz allow him to add some flair to his classical playing.
I think what the jazz does, improvising, it really helps bring that spontaneous element to my classical playing.
Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
You can find other stories in this new series on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. Thank you.
The number of low-income Medicaid patients accessing care in area emergency rooms is on the rise.
The increase seen at Aspen Valley and Valley View hospitals follows a national trend in states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
In 2014, the amount of business Aspen Valley Hospital did for Medicaid patients was triple the number in 2013. Hospital officials attribute the rise to Colorado expanding its Medicaid program. More Medicaid patients are getting lab tests, x-rays, and surgeries at the hospital. They're also visiting the emergency department, or ED, more often. The increase may sound large, but Hospital Chief Financial Officer Terry Collins says the effect is minimal.
It has not caused us to have to staff up or anything like that. It's just that we saw more Medicaid patients coming through the ED than we did normally, but that number is so small that it really had a negligible impact on our operation.
Down Valley, Valley View Hospital in Glenwood Springs has seen an increase. In 2007, Medicaid patients made up 8% of the hospital's total emergency room visits. In 2014, that number grew to more than 25%.
Our Medicaid numbers have tripled in the last 2 years.
Nan Sundin is the Director of Health and Human Services for Pitkin County.
We have over 1,400 people who were eligible for Medicaid and are now insured.
She says this group of newly insured patients has limited choices for care because many private doctors won't take them. The Medicaid reimbursement is low, so caring for them is expensive.
And they have to pay their staff, and they have overhead, and they have costs that make it very difficult for them. So the result is that our Medicaid population is going to the ER for medical care.
The sort of commonly held thought is that by expanding Medicaid and by the Affordable Care Act and the exchanges and creating insurance products for more people, that they would not use emergency departments for their care as often.
Dr. William Jaquist works in a Baltimore emergency room and sits on the board of the American College of Emergency Physicians, or ACEP.
But they would have an option to go to physician offices to get that care, or even urgent care clinics.
And that has turned out not to be the case.
That's true.
The ACEP released data in May showing 3/4 of emergency physicians in the United States report ER visits are going up.
We haven't really seen a big decline in people seeking care in emergency departments. We have seen an increase in acuity, but we haven't seen a decline in volume.
At Aspen Valley Hospital, the number of emergency room patients reporting they don't have a primary care doctor has also risen from 40% in 2013 to 67% last year. Still, Terry Collins at the hospital says he doesn't think there's a lack of care in the Upper Valley for low-income patients.
Because they can always come here, even if they don't have a doctor, they can come here. Now, is it the best place for them to come? Probably not in all cases.
A doctor's office may be the best choice for a sore throat, for example. The downsides of a visit to the ER are potential long waits and less familiarity with the patient. Pitkin County's Nan Sundin argues there is a lack of care for Medicaid patients. She'd like to see a solution.
We need a better way to provide health care than in the ER. It's not efficient, it's not economic, it doesn't make sense.
One idea is to create a clinic in Aspen that would serve low-income patients so they can receive care in a doctor's office instead of the emergency room.
A genre-bending band is playing in the Upper Valley this week. It's a primer to their upcoming performance at Red Rocks to play with the Colorado Symphony Orchestra. Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort reports.
Dvachka in Russian means little girl. But when someone says the word Dvachka in Colorado, it means the Grammy-nominated band from Denver. Their song, All the Sand and All the Sea, is a soaring and gradual climb. The Denver band, known for their work on the soundtrack of Little Miss Sunshine, has been described as gypsy rock and burlesque. And that's not a mistake. The band got their start as a backing group for burlesque shows. Dvachka will find themselves right at home at the Belly Up, but things will change when they perform next week with the Colorado Symphony Orchestra at Red Rocks. The bazooki-wielding, guitar-slinging, acrobatic-singing frontman of the band, Nick Urata, says that the dynamic changes not only when the venue gets bigger, but when the band on stage gets bigger.
It's a lot of moving parts. It takes a lot of ears and a lot of concentration, but the musical payoff is unrivaled.
As if Red Rocks wasn't already impressive, the Centennial State's premier orchestra will join one of the biggest bands from the area and adapt current songs to not only be played on a big stage, but with a big band.
You know, the orchestra is such a big organism that time is of the essence. So when we get in there, it's very much not too much talking, a lot of it's all business. We run the charts. If there's any problems, we point them out, run them again, and then move on. So it's very... kind of exciting that way.
The band recorded an album with the Symphony Orchestra a few years ago, but has now made it a habit to play with them each year. Urata says that every year he's surprised that they invite them back. It seems that Dvachka's music was made to be played with the symphony. Take the sequence from their song The Alley, where strings well up into the mix. The symphony swells and Nick's voice soars above the gliding strings while he vigorously strums his guitar in triple meter.
Sometimes, you know, melding a rock band with the orchestra takes a little finesse, and that's what we work out. You know, it's like when you're a four-piece band, you obviously fill up, you do things to be loud, and when you're playing with the orchestra, we have to kind of go in the opposite direction and be sure not to drown the orchestra out.
If the challenges of bringing music to the stage weren't intimidating enough, Urata says that just having a symphony playing his music instead of a more traditional repertoire was a bit frightening for him.
You know, we're a little bit out of our element with arranging our songs for so many players, and you know, they're used to playing pieces by the greatest composers known to men. You know, so to put our little charts up there on the stand next to that is a little intimidating. So try not to think about that. But
Nick says that in some ways, the smaller shows are a build-up to the larger shows, but he also pointed out that the differences create a distinct aesthetic. This song, called How It Ends, is perhaps one of their most recognizable. The repeating synth slowly fades into a march that builds in a subtle crescendo. Urata's cascading howl is drenched in a reverb and gets lost in itself as it's repeated. For Aspen Public Radio, I'm Patrick Fort reporting from the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. Have a nice afternoon. I'm Marcy Krivenin.
And I'm Elise Thatcher. To hear this show again or download a Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.